advertisement, and the court will proceed to the fourth case, Shockley versus Svoboda. Mr. Freiwager?
May it please the court, counsel. I am Steve Freiwager. I represent the counterclaim plaintiff and now the appellant in this action, Jacqueline Svoboda. The facts of this case are, I will summarize briefly. John Shockley and Richard Crockett were
professional... We've read all the briefs, you know.
Okay. Thank you. We are here on the appeal...
I'm not sure that gives you some comfort in that, but...
Well, we'll find out with the ruling, Your Honor. But Mr. Shockley and Mr. Crockett, in this case, shared office space together as professors in the Political Science Department of Western Illinois University.
They both have only one key to this office?
They must, according to...
What the record show here? Apparently, the suggestion that Shockley was locked out, that he couldn't...
The record shows in this case, Your Honor, that he was locked out for a total of 10 seconds.
But he hasn't the key?
I don't know what Mr. Shockley had at that time. But... Mr. Shockley extrapolated from prior behavior by what he observed with Mr. Crockett locking him out of the office for 10 seconds and seeing Mr. Crockett at a conference with my client in Chicago that they were having an affair. And Mr. Crockett was married at this time and then proceeded to inform not only the department chair, Charles Weston, that he perceived that they were having an affair, but also went on to tell other people in the department. After Mr. Weston informed him, I don't think there's much to this, I think you should keep this quiet, he proceeded to tell other fellow professors, he told the secretary, and then after being vehemently told that Mr. Crockett and Mrs. Svoboda absolutely denied that this affair was going on, he proceeded to tell a graduate student who Mrs. Svoboda happened to be dating at the time of his perceptions of this perceived affair. We are here because the court has granted summary judgment on the issue of whether or not Mr. Crockett's speech to the four professors within the department and to the secretary were within the scope of his employment as a university professor. The court... Mr. Shockley's speech was within the scope of his employment and protected, and therefore the speech of the state, and therefore, under the Pine decision, would have to be a claim brought in the Illinois Court of Claims. We reject that argument and state that the court pretty much was worn down in this case by multiple summary judgment motions in this proceeding, no less than four filed by Mr. Shockley on various theories. But at the end of the day, in this case, the court has erred in interpreting issues of material fact as to what was the intent of Mr. Shockley at the time of his speech. And we cite you specifically to the testimony of Dennis Hart. Dennis Hart, in this case, was one of the professors who Mr. Shockley called aside shortly after he came to his conclusion that this affair was going on, and brought him into a private conversation and started the conversation by saying, I think the professor and Ms. Svoboda are having an affair. And Dennis Hart's testimony shows that at no time at the broaching of this subject was Mr. Shockley speaking out on the matter of a public concern, namely the integrity of Western Illinois at that time. He was simply gossiping. He told him that he perceived this affair based on seeing them go to lunch together and also based on the fact that he saw him at a conference. It wasn't until Mr. Hart, later in that conversation, said, well, you know, I was at a University of Washington for a while, and they simply said, didn't have a policy against dating graduate students. The only thing was to make sure it didn't interfere with your professional abilities. That's when the light bulb went on, and Mr. Shockley turned this gossip into speaking out on matters of public concern. And in this case, we think that there's a question of fact as to what was the intent at that point. And we cite the court to numerous cases in our brief that discuss that issue, but we would cite the court to the McCullen versus City of Springfield case, a 2001 case, where it's noted that under Pine v. Whitner, it is really inappropriate to grant summary judgment because these are fact-specific cases. And you, to determine the intent of a person at the time that the statement is made rises or falls on what was happening in that context and the reasonable interpretation that may be given to it. And here, in the case of Barr, Judge Mim, after numerous orders saying that it was clear that it wasn't within the scope of employment, did a 360 in the December of 99 order and somehow accepted the affidavits of the university president, of the university attorney, who's now a late disclosed expert witness, and of the department chair, to say that these are all matters now within the scope of his employment authority as a professor at Western Illinois. They didn't introduce any evidence to show what the job description was for a university professor. They didn't introduce any actual testimony to show what the job description or duties on a day-to-day basis were of a professor. But I would think common sense would say that the reasonable job duties and responsibility of a professor is to teach, is to publish works, and is to, frankly, deal with your colleagues in a collegial manner. I don't think that gossiping about what he perceives as an affair going on between a graduate student and a professor is something that can be categorized under the Pine case as within the scope of his duties as a university professor. Second thing is the problem with the court's order in this case is it stops right there. Even though, even if you were to accept the trial court's reasoning here that this is within the scope of his employment duties, which we argue substantially against, you have to go to the Cherry versus Wild decision from the Illinois Supreme Court and determine whether or not he had an independent duty separate and apart from his job as a public official not to commit a tort. And in this case, he's committed the garden variety tort of slander, and he's also committed the garden variety tort of invading privacy by going to Mrs. Aboda's boyfriend and telling him about this affair that's going on. There is no protection for that under Illinois common law. If you look at the Whitaker versus Young case, which we cited at a Northern District 2001 case, it notes that a state employee who breaches a duty he owes, regardless of his state employment, is no more entitled to sovereign immunity than is a private individual who breaches that same duty. The mere fact of his state employment does not endow him with a heightened protection. This holds true even if the breach occurs during the scope of the official's duties. And that's citing from the Curie versus Lyle decision. And in this case, that's what's happened here. Mr. Shockley, cloaking himself with the sovereign immunity of the state of Illinois, says, I can go out then and tell anybody that somebody's having an affair without any factual basis to support that, and think that he's then immune from suit on that. The case cited in the Whitaker case shows that there is no such protection, and in fact, the Illinois Court of Claims in the O'Connor versus Smith case directly addresses that. It says citizens generally have a duty not to defame one another, independent of official status or duty. If this court affirms the trial court's decision in this situation, what happens is that Ms. Zaboda is then faced with the proposition of filing her claim against the state in the Illinois Court of Claims, and having the Illinois Court of Claims cite the O'Connor versus Smith decision back to her and say, you have no cause of action, because under common law, the individual is not immune from suit and is not protected by sovereign immunity. So the court has now put us in a catch-22 position, which cannot be defended, and we would argue that that the summary judgment in this case should be reversed. As to my second issue, the Supreme Court has addressed that already. We understand the court's ruling, and we won't argue that.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Steinberger. Mr. Siegel.
Thank you, Judge Cohen. My friend is turning the doctrine of a respondent superior on its head. I think there's a basic philosophical problem here. He does not want to be in the Court of Claims, which most plaintiffs do not. But respondent superior is a risk-sharing doctrine to help plaintiffs. And it's very liberal in favor of plaintiffs so that they can be compensated for the torts of employees. Now, it is not his own motive is not the determinative test of scope of employment. There's a factor test from the restatement, which is in the briefs, and I'm sure your honors have dealt with it. The McClellan case is totally an apposite. In fact, I represented the plaintiff in McClellan. It was the off-duty police officer in a bar altercation. Was he making an arrest, or was he aiding his brother-in-law? Question of fact. Classic questions of fact we see. One of the things I would note, and I noted in my brief, about the observation that, yes, most of the reported cases say that scope of employment is a question of fact, rarely appropriate for summary judgment. But that ignores the real world that goes on in the trial courts. The truck driver who stops to see his wife for lunch and takes a detour off an interstate and is in an accident, that issue never sees the jury, because it's usually conceded that he was acting in the scope of his employment, or the judge wouldn't even, sometimes it doesn't even come up on summary judgment. It's just that the jury instruction, he rules in effect a directed verdict and says, well, you know, of course he was. And the degree, of course my client contests, that's not for this proceeding, the that he was speaking falsely, but that's beyond it. We'll assume that at this stage it was summary judgment. But this court has already ruled on that point, I think, in Feldman versus Hull. You had a situation where a college professor at Southern Illinois University accused the a fellow of plagiarism. There was a First Amendment issue that got jurisdiction like here. And then the Judge Easterbrook, writing for the court, addresses in one paragraph and says, you know, faculty speak, teacher, collegiate faculty speak and write on subjects. That is their job. And when he was speaking and writing on professional conduct, that's in the scope of employment. It has to be brought in a court of claims. The same's true here. What the allegation was that Shockley was talking about was an affair between a faculty member, and this isn't somebody off in the music department, and he's teaching political science, which realistically doesn't have anything to do with integrity. This was his own student. And the other fact that was not said in oral argument, but it was addressed in the briefs, is that he was also raising the integrity issue of having an affair with a student and one who's grading his class, and secondly, was also integrity about keeping office hours. Now, my friend cites the testimony of Mr. Hart, but I quoted for you on page 19 of my brief the portion where Mr. Hart testifies that he's having a discussion about what he should do, talking to a fellow faculty member. And Hart's own words, which I quote, are that I've seen this many times with professors when they get an idea and they're mulling it over in their mind, that I mentioned professionalism, and Shockley goes, oh, yes, and he starts to light up. Well, that's precisely a intellectual conversation that professors have all the time. His issue is, what should I do about it? Should I just let it lie? Or should I go ahead and bring charges? So he was doing what faculty members do in a university, is going out and getting input from his fellow faculty members. His purpose in doing this was, in part, and that's all it has to be, to serve his master. And Judge Min found that the objective there, under the objective test of the evidence of the department head and the president, they said, well, this is all in this, that's what he's got a duty to do. Now, I have a little problem with this independent duty requirement, because the example of a truck driver we use, he's got an independent duty to use his truck with reasonable care, but when in that situation, I think it turns the scope of employment on its head, because he's working for his master, and of course he does, the duty arises out of his employment because he's driving his master's truck. The same here. Yes, you have a duty not to defame people on these facts. Shockley could prevail.
Of course, he went too far with that truck. He got a frolic of his own, and then it wouldn't apply anyway.
Oh, of course.
Christian Hare, using some analogy, is when the professor was in a frolic of his own when he was spreading around the discussion about who was having an affair with whom.
Well, the
stimulating discussion, I'm sure, for academic circles, but I mean it's
about what to do about a integrity problem, which
who was doing what to whom?
Well, yes, but we start with the basic subject, faculties, sex.
Well, basic subject is sex, but go ahead.
Between a faculty and a student member who's under his control.
Whatever.
Which is the classic sexual harassment, quid pro quo situation. The university...
He was preventing a sexual harassment case from arising or getting out of hand? Is that the position?
Well, maybe not. Maybe he's just concerned about the integrity of the university if she's a willing participant and doesn't want to bring a sexual harassment case, even though she can. It still doesn't make it proper. It perverts the grading process. Because think about it. Even if you have the completely willing faculty member and the student who does, who meets the definition of harassment because the person's in the superior and would never bring suit, that still has an integrity problem for everybody else in that class who's getting graded.
So the initial contacts are with these two professors, is that it?
Yes.
Are they in some line of responsibility about this, or are they just other faculty members? I mean,
they're members of the department.
Of the department?
Yeah, of his department. He talked in his department. And by the way, there were two instances which the appellant has abandoned where Judge Mim said he was out of the scope of his employment. He talked to two former faculty members in Chicago, and he said that...
Boyfriend.
And a boyfriend. Yeah, and so it wasn't that Judge Mim wasn't considering this carefully. He said the boyfriend in the Palmer House meeting here down the street, he said that's out of the scope of the employment. But these others, when he's talking to his fellow colleagues about what should we do about this, and I come back to the integrity issue that, it's established now throughout universities, and you see it in your sexual harassment law, that when you hold a position of power over someone, you shouldn't be having relationships with them. Or, you should certainly get out entirely, essentially recuse yourself, let somebody else teach the class and you wouldn't be grading them. But that wasn't the case here. And was he acting in the scope of his employment? And there's a very liberal pro-plane view, yes. Example I can think of extreme, I was thinking last night, police torture of a suspect, no matter how vile the motive, if it serves the master, it's within the scope of the employment.
the hypothetical I thought of is the salesman taking out the client trying to make a sale and then driving home drunk. It's outrageous, but it's in the scope of his employment. And that was what was
happening. Well, with these different vignettes, as you're playing out, Mr. Siegel, is it clear that it's subject to the question of acting in the scope of employment is so clear that it wouldn't require a jury determination? Is that a judgment?
Well, on the evidence, the testimony of the faculty department head, the president, and the attorney, and all those complaints that the appellant voices are, of course, discretionary calls, the balls and strike calls you give an experienced trial judge. Yes, the only evidence on summary judgment was everybody says, well, yeah, this is what a professor should be doing.
Thank you, Mr. Spiegel. Mr. Spiegel, your turn to explain, but you may have a minute if you have time. Case is taken, thanks to both counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.